Colleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, and we are going to be talking about money spent on political advertising and a few related topics this hour. Do you know almost $200, as you heard in the news, $200 million has been spent on TV advertising so far during this presidential year? The overwhelming amount of recent spending coming from the race for the Democratic nomination. In total, Democratic candidates for the president have spent close to $135 million on campaign advertising, while Republican candidates have spent some $57 million. A lot of this money has been spent by Barack Obama, and our guest this hour will break down the different time periods in which Obama won 9 straight contests, netting 118 delegates, and had a huge advantage in advertising. It doesn't completely explain his victories in those contests, but we'll look at the advertising air war and how significant advertising was in what will probably be his over-the-top win tonight. You know, barely, but that's what we're expecting tonight. We'll be looking at this and a few other issues. You know, the pulling of an ad from Dunkin' Donuts, we'll talk about that and how politics was involved in that issue, and other issues with Professor Ken Goldstein. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project, author of Interest Groups, Lobbying and Participation in America, Campaign Advertising and American Democracy. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project. The results of this study of the campaign released today and is all over the news today. Overall, Senator Obama outspent Senator Hillary Clinton $78 million to $49 million on TV ads, and our professor says if this was a basketball game, he won the third quarter. The third quarter was arguably the ball game. Professor Goldstein, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
This is so much money, isn't it? It's just an amazing amount of money.
Yeah, and it's going to be much, much more.
Yeah, right.
This sounds like a lot of money that's been spent in the presidential primaries and has been more than has been spent in previous presidential primaries on the air. If we talk again in the late summer, if we talk again in the fall, this is going to seem like really, really small potatoes in terms of the total amount spent.
Why have the Democrats had so much more money than the Republicans to spend on ads?
Well, there's been much more enthusiasm. There's been a race on the Democratic side is the easy answer. There's been much more enthusiasm on the Democratic side in this election cycle, both in terms of turnout and the number of people giving money and the amount of people giving money. And the Democratic game, and we talked about four quarters, the Democratic primary just keeps going. It's in way extra innings, and
yeah,
it goes on and on and on. More money needs to be spent.
Mm-hmm. What did you mean when you said if this was a basketball game, you were quoted in today's Journal Sentinel, Obama won the third quarter?
Well, if you look at the presidential primary schedule in four parts, so the first part is, or the first quarter, are the early primaries, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada. And then the second quarter is the massive number of primaries that were on February 5th, Super Duper Tuesday. And then the third quarter is 9 primaries that were between February 5th and February 19th, with Wisconsin being the last primary on February 19th. And then the fourth quarter were all the primaries that occurred after that, Ohio, Texas, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Indiana. And if you look at how the candidates did in terms of gaining pledged delegates, they broke even in that first quarter, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. They broke essentially even, almost exactly even, on Super Tuesday in terms of the number of pledged delegates they won. If you look at what happened after Wisconsin, they've been splitting those pledged delegates, Hillary Clinton having big wins in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, winning in Texas but actually losing the delegate battle there,
mm-hmm,
losing in North Carolina, losing in Oregon. But where Barack Obama really, really gained his 120, 130, 150 lead in pledged delegates was those February 5th to February 19th, the third quarter, if you will, where he went 9-0. So I'm a little bit of a basketball fan, and if you watch college basketball and you see the Badgers when they go on a run, you can see that you can play a 40-minute game, but a 2 or 3 minute stretch in the game can get you that advantage that wins you the game. And the run that the Barack Obama campaign made was those February 5th to February 19th states, those 9 straight states where he went 9-0.
How did they get all the money?
Well, it's interesting. There's a big difference in how the candidates raise the money. Certainly, a big proportion of Barack Obama's money has also come from people maxing out, giving the maximum $2,300 donation. But the big story with Barack Obama is over 1.5 million people have given money on the Internet, $15, $20, $50, $100. And the amount of money that Barack Obama has raised is certainly a big story, but the number of people from which he's raised that money is even a bigger story.
Mm-hmm. And did Senator Clinton go after people on the Internet in the same way or not?
Only later in the game. So her fundraising strategy early on was to go after the big givers, to go after people who she called hill climbers, people who would bundle money, get friends to give, and just go after those $2,300 maximum checks. Those people, though, the problem with those people is they can't give any more once they've given. So once Hillary Clinton was sitting on February 6th without much money, she had to loan her own campaign money, which got her into late in the month, and then she turned to trying to raise money on the Internet, and a staple of her speeches has been giving her Internet address and asking for money over the Internet. And when Clinton won in places like Ohio and Texas in early March, or won in Pennsylvania in mid-April, she also got a significant amount of funds over the Internet.
Mm-hmm. But he was still outspending her by a pretty big margin, wasn't he? Or at least she referenced that.
Yeah. So again, in the third quarter where he went 9-0 and really won this race, he was outspending her 3-1, 4-1, even 5-1 in some states. In the fourth quarter, he was still outspending her, but he was only outspending her 2-1, and there were no days or no states where she was dark. So the real difference between that what we're calling that third quarter of the presidential election campaign, not only did he have an advantage, but he had a massive advantage. Not only did he have a massive advantage, but there were literally days when she was not on the air. So if you remember Wisconsin, he was up on the air for 4 or 5 days in a very, very short campaign that we had in Wisconsin. He was on the air for 4 or 5 days before she even came up.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the case in the fourth quarter, even though she was outspending him. And then the other big difference is he had a massive advantage in paid media in that third quarter, plus the Reverend Wright hadn't hit. His bitter comments hadn't hit. So he was generally getting favorable or neutral coverage from the free press in the earned media.
Mm.
And even though he had an advantage in advertising after February 19th, the advantage wasn't as big. Plus, he was getting pounded 24/7 on the cable networks with Reverend Wright with his bitter comments.
Right.
And there's just no way advertising is going to have that big of an effect when you're running in the face of lots of free media.
Right. Was there a substantial difference, Professor Goldstein, in the nature of the ads that were run by both campaigns?
A couple things. People talk a lot about how this was a nasty campaign, a negative campaign, a big battle. There were certainly some tense moments. There were certainly some things said in speeches. There were certainly some things said by surrogates. But when it came to what was advertised on the air, it was mostly pretty positive fare. There were very, very few negative ads in general. The Clinton campaign was likely to go more negative than the Obama campaign. But there weren't any pure negative spots, meaning a spot when you only talk about your opponent. Even when there was negative information going about the opponent, they tended to mostly be contrast ads, and they also comprised a very, very small proportion of the total number of ads that were aired. A couple other little interesting things from the project. Barack Obama was much more likely to narrate his own ads than Hillary Clinton.
Really?
So a Barack Obama ad had Barack Obama speaking, often directly to the camera, or it was just snippets or cuts from a Barack Obama speech. Hillary Clinton's ads were much more likely to be with a narrator giving her message rather than with her giving her message.
Well, that's interesting. Why did they go those different strategies, and what difference did it make to the people who watched them?
Yeah, I could go into lots and lots of explanations, but who do you think's a better speaker, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton?
Right.
You can be a Hillary Clinton fan. You can be not a big fan of Barack Obama, but clearly he does better speaking directly to camera than she does.
Right. And tell me about the analysis that you've done of whether or not we watch these ads. Sometimes there are so many of them that you just, I don't know, I would think it tunes some of them out.
Sure. Listen, at some point, television advertising is not going to be the major way that candidates get their message out. We're not at that point now. But as you say, There's massive amounts of ads in particular areas, so there's obviously a diminishing marginal return for these advertisements. Also, the way people watch television is much more fragmented. Everyone's not sitting down and watching the same shows, and it's much harder for political advertisers to place their ads in on shows where lots of eyes are going to get them. The main place where there's eyes that these political advertisers are looking for is on local news.
Right.
And local television news remains the single greatest source for most Americans for news, even in the age of the Internet, even with terrific Wisconsin talk radio, public radio, et cetera. Most Americans get most of their news from local news.
Heaven help us if that's the case.
You have things like TiVo now.
Yeah, that's right. Zip through those ads.
Where people will record things and watch it afterwards. But people typically do not DVR news broadcasts. So that's why when we look at where the ads are placed, well over half, 50, 60% of the ads are placed on local news or news magazines or morning news shows, which is where the campaigns think they can get the most amount of eyes, the most amount of eyes that aren't going to skip over their ads, and the most amount of eyes that are likely to be voters.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, and tell me how different it will be once we go into the general campaign, that we were doing ads, or the candidates were, in virtually every state. Is that going to change once we go into the general election? We're just going to look at the huge states that really matter?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a terrific question. The report that we put out yesterday looks very different than reports you've seen in the past and reports you're going to see in the future. Why? Because on the big table two that we have, you see advertising everywhere. It's because of the rules. So to be a geeky political scientist for a second, the Democratic primary rules were proportional representation. So it made sense to advertise in a state, even if you were going to win it comfortably or even if you were going to lose it comfortably, because the more votes you got, even if you lost the state, you would get proportionally more delegates. Of course, in a general election with the Electoral College, it's winner take all. And so we're going to see a lot of advertising in Wisconsin, like we saw a ton of advertising in Wisconsin in 2000 and 2004. But in other states, California, Utah, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Texas, which got lots of advertising in this presidential primary race, they're unlikely to see anything in a general election because those are states that either the Democrat will win comfortably or the Republican will win comfortably. And if you're not going to win it, and if it's not going to be close, it's just not worth it to advertise.
What about the fact that much has been made, this is such a Democratic year, that those states that traditionally have voted Republican may be up for play this go-around?
Well, you know how we're going to know? By looking at the advertising. So we often talk about advertising being something we want to look at advertising's effect. But advertising, if any of your listeners are poker players, can also be a tell. It can also tell you what the campaigns are thinking. So the campaigns can talk a lot about how they're going to expand the Electoral College map, how they're going to go into other states, how they're going to campaign hard in other states. But if they're not airing advertising there, then they're not serious. So if later this summer we start to see advertising in states where we typically don't see advertising, we'll know it's for real that the Electoral College map is expanding. If we don't see advertising in those places, we'll know it was just talk.
And when is all this general campaign advertising going to start?
It would not surprise me if it was as early as the next couple weeks.
Really?
If Hillary Clinton will drop out of the race in some way, shape, or form, I would expect in either the next day or the next week, although she's really the only person who knows what she's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I think you're going to see a flush of cash to Barack Obama, and I think he's going to massively go up on the air very quickly, and I think the Republican National Committee will then try and match that, and then we will have a fully engaged ad campaign right through the first week in November.
Right.
I mean, if you remember in 2004, when we saw the first general election ads in Wisconsin, was March 4th.
No.
Yep.
Was it really?
Yep.
March 4th?
Yep. That's when the first Bush ads aired in Wisconsin in 2004, and we basically saw general election levels like you would usually see in late October. We saw that from March all the way to November in Wisconsin in 2004.
I had forgotten that. This has been quite a race, hasn't it? Here we are, the last states are voting tonight. It went all the way to the end.
Well, I talked with one of your colleagues in late December, and I did not think I would be talking to you again in mid-June, and the presidential primary would still be going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. So tell me, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen tonight, but what's going to happen tonight?
We really don't know what's going to happen. We know that Barack Obama will likely win South Dakota and Montana. If he doesn't, they'll be very close races. We know what's going to happen with the delegates. There's only 31 delegates at stake tonight. They will split pretty evenly. We know, and it could be happening now, that superdelegates are going to start to move towards Barack Obama in pretty big ways. He's going to try and get enough, so he's going to be able to declare victory tonight. And then Hillary Clinton's really the only person who knows what she is going to do, and perhaps Bill Clinton knows what she's going to do as well, and figure out a way for her to gracefully exit this race.
When I think about it, and I've thought about it a lot the last week or so, I still think it's so astounding. Do you, Professor Goldstein, that we have, as our presidential candidate, a multiracial man? This is a big thing in American history.
Everyone has talked about it. It's the obvious thing, but it really is amazing how fast we went from 0 to 60. I think if you took a survey of a panel of political scientists or historians 3 years ago and asked them how long in America until we have a African-American or multiracial president, they would not have said 2 years.
Right.
I think most would have assumed we would have a woman president before an African-American American president. And things just moved extraordinarily quickly. Politics can be like that. You look at Bill Clinton's, success in 1992, and we all, remember Bill Clinton as president and as, at least up into this campaign, as someone with very powerful political skills. He caught a lot of lucky breaks. He caught a lot of lucky breaks his whole career. And for everything to align for a candidate to win the presidency, certainly there's fundamental factors about the candidate's personality, but it's just a lot of little lucky breaks going your way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We're talking about the Wisconsin Advertising Project, directed by our guest, Professor Ken Goldstein, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-author of Campaign Advertising in American Democracy, and they have done an extensive examination of the primary advertising and looked at where Senator Obama spent his money and how it may have been key to his probable nomination or win, which may take place tonight or tomorrow. Phenomenal amount of money spent, how he gathered it, how it was used, how Senator Hillary Clinton used her money. We're talking about all of that. And we have a few other issues to discuss, too, as we move on here. So join us. Our lines are filled, but you could send an email if you want. We'll get to some of those. talk@WPR.org or 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's hop to some phone calls. We go to David from South Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Kathleen, wonderful show. I read the book Freakonomics, and there's an interesting chapter in there, and I'll try to briefly and fairly summarize the point regarding funding of elections. It was a study of congressional campaigns and successive congressional campaigns in situations where the candidates spent more money in successive campaign years. And it was determined by that study that no matter how much money a person spent, once we got to know you, you can't buy my vote. And the professor, I'm probably being a little perjurative, but I'm getting a little bit of sense that it could be suggested from this conversation that Barack Obama and his, nickel and dime supporters on the internet have bought the election. But I don't think so. I think we use that money to introduce him and his belief in perfecting the American dream. We just introduced him, and I think once you introduce a candidate, you really can't buy a vote. You can only introduce your candidate, perhaps effectively. And could I get the professor's comment on that, please?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's a super question. We gotta get you in political science graduate school. What you're speaking about, first of all, what you're speaking about in Freakonomics is a big debate in political science. What's the actual effect of money in congressional elections? And the long-time finding is money doesn't matter so much for incumbents because we already know them. You're not going to teach people much new about incumbents, but that money can matter for challengers. And there's actually this also very weird finding that the more money an incumbent spends, the less the less likely they are to win, the fewer votes they get. Now, why is that? When does an incumbent spend lots of money? When they're in trouble. And so when an incumbent's spending lots of money, it means they're in a tough race, it means they're going to get fewer votes. Listen, the point of this report was not to suggest at all that Barack Obama won the election or bought the election because of his advantage in advertising. Advertising matters. Spending money matters. But it matters at the margin by a couple percentage points. Now, we're in a time in American politics, we're in a presidential primary where the margin matters, where 1, 2, 3, 4 percentage points can make the difference. But, as David said, as the caller also said, advertising's also much more likely to matter when people need to learn more. So Hillary Clinton's money, Hillary Clinton's advertising, Hillary Clinton's campaign was less likely to have an effect than Barack Obama's. Why? We already knew Hillary Clinton. Some people liked her, some people didn't like her. There were not a lot of people who had mixed feelings about her or who didn't know her at all. With Barack Obama, he had to introduce himself. There was a lot for people to learn about Barack Obama, and what Barack Obama's massive amount of money that he raised enabled him to do was to introduce himself to people on his own terms. So when we talk about Barack Obama winning that third quarter, yeah, he got a lot of national attention up through there, but then he came to those 9 states, and those 9 states still had to be introduced to Barack Obama, and he had the funds and he had the overwhelming advantage to introduce himself to those people in those February 5th to February 19th states on his own terms.
Mm-hmm. And do we still have a lot to learn about him?
Certainly. I think we're gonna continue to learn more, both with the press, and also I think that's going to start to be now what the Republicans try and do, is trying to define Barack Obama. One of the great advantages that the Republicans had by this Democratic primary fight going on is, instead of $300 million going to define John McCain since mid-February or mid-March, if the Democrats would have wrapped up their nomination, the Republicans have had a chance to sit back, raise money, do their opposition research, not take any fire on their own, and I think we're going to start to see the Republicans try and actively define Barack Obama as well. The other thing which we saw is Barack Obama was not as well known, but was massively had massive positive ratings before late February. As he became better known, and as more negative information came out, as the Clinton campaign was also pushing more negative information, Barack Obama got introduced to people in March and April in a much more negative fashion, and you can see that in his approval ratings. You can mm-hmm. see that in his favorability ratings.
Right. Thanks, David, for the call. Milton from West Dallas. Hi.
Ads are only a small part of media exposure for politicians nowadays. Only a few short campaigns ago, there really wasn't nearly as much wall-to-wall, 24-hour discussion on all the cable channels and on all the talk channels. Now it's only a small part of media exposure. And gatekeeper labels and early decisions by media management early in the race is what looks like makes the big difference to me. And I'd like to know, who are the people who make these decisions? We know that people in media can be paid. I mean, look at the Bush administration scandal, where they applied war propaganda and other political propaganda money to people in the media. So we certainly know they can be bought. And what makes all the difference is getting a few key people on board behind the scenes. And if the American people really are still making any kind of decisions about voting from these ads that are so, so bad, then I think they deserve to live in probably the coming totalitarian state.
Professor Goldstein.
Well, there's a lot to comment on there, and a lot of empirical and normative claims. So first of all is the claim that it's the news that matters, that it's the free media that matters and not advertising. Both matter, I think, is the simple answer. And different sorts of people get information from ads and might get information from the cable networks. We talk about the cable networks, but if you look at the ratings of the cable networks, if you look at the actual numbers of people watching the cable networks, it's fairly small. and it's folks who tend to be politically involved, politically interested, politically partisan, and really to have already made up their mind. Now, that said, does the free media narrative, does the focus of the free media influence elections? Absolutely. And you can see the change in the tenor of media coverage of both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, especially Barack Obama, over the course of the campaign. The caller seems to have much greater concerns about the role of the national media, and we can certainly point to times when we think that national media coverage was not focused in the correct place or its quality wasn't high. But the short answer to that is there is not a little room in New York City or Washington, D.C., where these three media people sit and come up with that narrative. There's lots of structural reasons and, yes, political reasons and fundamental reasons how the news ends up getting shaped, which might be a much too long a discussion for this morning. But I think the other key point is, you know, it's hard to say both that the media world is completely fragmented and that it's also dominated and we can't find out information. There are tremendous numbers of outlets for people to get a tremendous variety of information sources and opinion out there, from the internet to public radio to talk radio to CNN to Fox to the national networks.
And I'm one of those.
To think that someone like you sitting down with Rush Limbaugh, sitting down with Wolf Blitzer, sitting down with ABC News, sitting down with people on the internet to come up with one meta narrative is probably not correct.
Yeah. I'm amazed how many hours I've spent watching all of this over the past year. I find it endlessly fascinating. I'm not sure how good it is for me, but it has just been, it's absorbed my life. I don't know what's going to, I'll just be depressed when it's all over.
Right, well, I think you'll have at least to November. It's going to keep going
right
now in the
that's
summer.
True.
You won't be bored over the summer,
no,
I guarantee you.
That's true.
But you look at the ratings on the cable networks, CNN and MSNBC, for instance, are completely driven by huge interest in the Democratic primary fight.
And isn't it amazing how they've been able for months now, Professor Goldstein, to keep it going hour after hour after hour after hour?
Amazing is one word, yes.
They're filling time, too, aren't they?
They're filling time.
Right. Jim from Anona is next. Hi, Jim.
Yes, I wonder if the professor would comment. I'm of an age where, when I was young, I was schooled in something called the liberal arts. And that was supposed to give us a means to protect ourselves from lies and deceptions, especially propaganda. But from the way you're speaking, that's impossible nowadays because the liberal arts have disappeared and advertising language has taken over. So there is no truth or fact. There's only large numbers of opinions, and nothing is true and nothing is false. There's just the power of manipulating images and words. What do you say to the universities, to say to the young people, we have to protect ourselves from PR and advertising, and here's how you do it? What do you say?
Well, a couple things. I think the liberal arts are alive and well. The liberal arts are certainly alive and well at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and liberal arts are certainly alive and well at lots of University of Wisconsin system schools. When we teach political science, we're teaching about substantive things we know about political science, but our main goal is to teach our students how to think, teach our students how to write, teach our students how to think, teach our students how to analyze, teach our students how to evaluate. So I'm not so sure that the liberal arts are dead at least at the University of Wisconsin and among many American universities. Now, speaking to what the effect of all these ads are, I think our first gut is these ads are manipulating us, and these ads are, people are just listening to these ads, and these awful ads are making people do things and putting things into people's minds that wouldn't normally be there. And I think, as we've talked about before on this show, that conventional wisdom is simply wrong. There's lots of dopey things we may point to in ads. There's certainly particular ads that we can talk about that are particularly offensive or particularly inaccurate. But in general, and the empirical evidence is extraordinarily strong on this, people actually learn from political advertisements. People
really?
Actually get shortcuts from political advertisements. People actually get information from political advertisements. And people who are exposed to political advertisements are more likely to be interested in the campaign, more likely to be engaged in the campaign, more likely to vote in the campaign, more likely to know empirically accurate facts about the candidates.
Hmm. How many companies are putting these ads together these days? Is it just a handful who make it their expertise?
It's a change we've seen in the last 15 or 20 years. It used to be in presidential campaigns that the candidates would bring in folks from Madison Avenue to do their ads from the commercial advertising campaigns. But in the last 20 years, there's now a very well-developed and mature political consulting, political advertising companies in Washington, D.C., who all they do is politics and public affairs work.
Let's go to Bob from Darlington. Hello, Bob.
Thanks for taking my call, Kathleen.
Sure.
And Professor Goldstein, I've got an interesting question for you. Whatever happened to McCain-Feingold finance reform law? How it's being developed?
Sure. McCain-Feingold is still the law of the land. There's one perhaps small exception to that we can talk about that. But passed after 2002, McCain-Feingold upped the amount of money that individuals could give. It made restrictions on the unlimited funds that parties could raise. And contrary to what lots of people think, McCain-Feingold did not stop interest groups, was not meant to stop interest groups from being involved in the political process. What it said was, if interest groups use particular types of funds, then they can't mention or depict a candidate for federal office within 60 days of a general election or 30 days of a primary. If they raise hard money, if they raise money in small amounts from many people, interest groups could still say whatever they want, at whatever levels they want, at whatever time they wanted to. And so the notion that McCain-Feingold would completely change how campaigns would be done, completely change how political advertising would be deployed, I think was perhaps hyperbole on both opponents of McCain-Feingold and supporters of McCain-Feingold. Candidates are still able to raise money, and the amount of money they can raise has actually increased. So we continue to see candidate spending go up, and we continue to see money spent on political advertising. But you can go on the web and see the names of everybody who gave money to Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain. What we don't have is the massive amounts of money going in unregulated fashion to the parties. There's still issues. These 527 groups are very difficult to track. It's very difficult to know who is giving money to them. And with the Supreme Court decision in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, it may open up again the ability of interest groups to be actively engaged in election campaigns with money that is very difficult for people to trace.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Bob, for your call. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Ken Goldstein, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project. They released a report today which is receiving a lot of national attention, and it looks at the amount of money that has been spent during the 2008 primary candidate ads and the influence of how much money was raised, who raised the most, when those ads were placed, and the impact that it had on the primaries. Fascinating study. So we're welcoming phone calls for Professor Goldstein, and we have lines open after they've been pretty crowded for the hour. Now is your chance to get a line and talk to us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, Milwaukee 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, and our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Ken Goldstein is our guest. We're talking about political advertising. Just a quick sidelight because I'm interested in your response to this, Professor Goldstein. What did you think of Dunkin' Donuts pulling this commercial featuring Rachel Ray wearing what some have said was a keffiyeh, and conservative bloggers have said this is the traditional scarf of Arab men that has come to symbolize murderous Palestinian jihad? Is this a little too much, or do they have a point?
I got to admit, I don't know a lot about this, and the only way I found out about this, I was standing in line at Whole Foods the other day, and we were having a barbecue, and I bought the Rachel Ray magazine, and the person at Whole Foods, the checkout person, told me all about this story.
Isn't that interesting?
And so then I went and, like a good researcher, Googled it and saw the entire story. Seems to be one of these silly dust-ups which we get from time to time.
Right. Yeah. Do political groups have a big effect on advertising, be it something like that or other kinds of advertising? Are their influence waning or rising?
Political groups in terms of commercial advertisers or what?
Yeah, being able to put pressure on places to pull ads.
Listen, I think that's happened from time to time in American politics. I think when you have the internet now and bloggers, you do have the ability for people in very far flung areas to communicate very quickly and then dedicate their fire in a very direct manner towards something. That's something we've seen with talk radio in the past.
Sure.
And I'm sure something we're going to continue to see down the line.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about those 527 groups. We've seen some really vicious, nasty ads in the last two presidential campaigns. Are you anticipating more of that or not?
Sure. I think we're going to see interest groups engage in this presidential campaign sooner rather than later. We have not seen a lot of interest group or 527 advertising to date. I think we will see significant 527 spending in general elections, and some of that will be negative. Listen, is it vicious? Is it unfair? I can't remember all the other adjectives you use. Certainly, we can point to ads that some people will feel are over the top or unfair. But I think ultimately we gotta believe in speech here. I think it's important that we know who's funding those ads. I think that's the very key point.
Mm-hmm.
What disturbs me about 527s is not what they're saying. What disturbs me about 527s is who's paying for it.
Right.
So I want people to be able to know who's paying for the ads. In terms of the content, I don't want to get in the business of saying what's allowed and what's not. And looking back on 2004, and I've given this example before, I think the one ad that people remember from 2004 is the Swift Boat ad.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would consider that vicious or unfair or inaccurate. Without even me getting into normatively assessing what I think of the ad, our system demands that there's two competent campaigns. And the reason why the Swift Boat ad was effective was that the Kerry campaign never countered it. The Kerry campaign, I think, responded to the Swift Boat ad for the first time a couple months ago, which was about 4 years too late.
Yeah, right.
And I think we're going to see interest group ads, but I do not think we're going to have a case where one side is not able to respond to what other groups are saying.
And how do we find out who's paying for them?
It's very difficult. There's all sorts of different ways that these groups can be structured, and often it's impossible to find out where the true money is coming from until after the election.
All right, let's go back to phone.
And that's a real problem.
Right, yeah, it is.
That's a real problem.
Right. Dave from Wanakee, hi.
Yes, hello. When a black preacher said something negative about white America, it was given a 24-hour-a-day endless loop on Fox News and CNN. When a white preacher whose endorsement John McCain sought and received said something more outrageous, that Hitler was God's instrument and the Holocaust was a means of getting to the rapture, it died in a day. Could you comment on the inherent prejudice in the news media? It seems pretty apparent to me.
Well, I think the difference there is, and there was clearly intense coverage of Reverend Wright 24/7 on all the on all the cable networks, and also intense coverage on the national broadcast networks and the newspapers, etc. I think the reason why that got significantly more attention was because the Reverend Wright was actually Barack Obama's minister, rather than simply one person who had endorsed him. Was the amount of that coverage perhaps more than one would like to see in a campaign? Perhaps out of balance. Yes, but the reason why it got significantly more was because it was Barack Obama's actual minister, and not simply one who had endorsed him.
Anything more, Dave?
Well, I would disagree with that. I think that the when a candidate actively seeks an endorsement and receives it, and then we find out that the person that he sought the endorsement from has said some really terrible things. I've noticed that I've never heard the things that Reverend Hagee said on Wisconsin Public Radio, for one thing. And these are things that are on YouTube. You can easily find them. You can copy them down, you know, download them and put them on the air. But Wisconsin Public Radio chooses not to.
I haven't put any of the comments on. I was wondering
why that is.
We haven't done that on this show. That's all I can speak for. We haven't played any of them.
I mean, again, I think Reverend Hagee, who's a minister in Texas, I think the fundamental difference there again is he's not John McCain's minister, whereas the Reverend Wright was Barack Obama's minister. Listen, I'm a political scientist and would love to do the analysis, but I imagine if you went and looked at the things that surrogates and supporters have said of John McCain, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, etc., all of those people have received much less coverage than someone who was Barack Obama's actual minister, the one who married him.
Thanks, Dave, for the call. Larry from West Bend. Hi, Larry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to the professor is, you know, given the amount of money that's being spent on political campaigns these days, not only the presidential, but the recent Supreme Court justice campaign, is there any proposals on the table to limit the amount of money that can be spent on a campaign and the amount of time that they can actually campaign, not only for the presidential, but for, you know, general elections, too?
Yeah, there's no proposals, and I think they would, I'm not sure how they would work to limit the amount of time that someone could campaign. There are a number of proposals at the state level and also at the federal level in terms of campaign finance reform or campaign reform. I think we're in an environment where it's going to be very difficult to get those sorts of things passed. I think at this point, neither party has tremendous incentive to do those things, and they're the ones who are going to have to do it. There is public concern, but it is clearly not at the top of the public's list. And so I would think there's probably not a high degree of likelihood that we're going to see much in terms of financial or political reform. There's a whole political reform movement in Wisconsin. There's all sorts of things being debated, but that proved to be a pretty tough road to hoe.
It is something we've been talking about this so long, and so many people agree it would be a good thing to change the system, and the system just never gets changed.
Sure, and I think we'll continue to see incremental change, and I think we can point to things that we'd like to see changed. And listen, I, for one, I'm not even sure it's too much money that's spent in politics. Look at the amount of money that the car companies spend, or Procter & Gamble spends, or Coca-Cola spends. It's much more than we've been spent on political campaigns. And people need to know about their candidates and need to get information. What concerns me is when there's imbalances, when one side is able to out-scream the other, out-advertise the other, out-campaign the other. And in most competitive campaigns in Wisconsin, in most competitive campaigns in the United States, resources are extant, that the campaigns are able to get their messages out. And then the other thing that really concerns me is I want to know who's given the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing for the money to be spent. It's one thing for the money to be given. But I think we deserve, as citizens, to know who is contributing that money.
Mm-hmm. My memory could be way off on this, Professor Goldstein, but it strikes me that I used to remember a time in television and radio when political campaigns had somewhat of a lower rate just in terms of serving the public interest. Do you know about that? Are they charged top rate now at television and radio stations all over the country?
It very much depends. It's a market. Campaigns will be offered lowest unit rate for a certain amount of advertisements. But when you buy at lowest unit rate, you have less control and you're less assured about when your ads are going to air.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think when the Barack Obama campaign was going into television stations in Wisconsin, they wanted to make sure their ads got on when they wanted them to get on and in the amount they wanted them to get on. So they were likely paying top of the rate card.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Larry, for the call. Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Very interesting topic, especially following your previous program. I would like to ask your guest if there's some qualitative difference in the type of information and learning that you get from these political advertisements, as distinct from, say, a genuine debate as would have once been arranged by the League of Women's Voters, where more complex interchanges and ideas might be on display? And what is the type of learning that occurs from campaign ads? Thank you.
A couple things. It's not like we don't have debates anymore. I think we had 22 or 23 debates on the Democratic side alone during these primaries, and we had five or six debates that were just Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama. And we're also going to have more debates this fall between Barack Obama and John McCain. Sure, different things are learned from a debate than are learned from political advertisements. And I often think of political advertisements as a small little vitamin. It can be part of a regular nutritious political diet, and that regular nutritious political diet should be reading newspapers, watching television news, looking at debates, looking at candidate websites, and at the margin you can learn something from these political advertisements as little vitamins. They can give people shortcuts and point them in the right direction, but you shouldn't only eat vitamins, you shouldn't only eat political ads.
Thanks very much for the call. We have time for a couple more phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Here's an email question from Ken from De Pere. Have there been any studies done showing the relationship, if any, between negative political ads and consumer confidence?
I'm not sure what they're asking, meaning that there's more negative ads on the economy. People are less optimistic about how
right.
the economy is going.
Right. Let's take it from there.
I don't think anything's been done on that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll get to that at UW.
Okay. And tell me more. You're not only doing presidential races here. You're doing political advertising in gubernatorial races and federal races all over the country this year, aren't you?
Yeah, we'll be tracking advertising everywhere, like we've been doing since 2000. It's just this. Presidential ad war is sucking up all the oxygen in the room, so that's what we paid attention to in this first report. But we'll be tracking in all the House of Representative races and all the Senate races. We tracked in some of the special elections that happened this spring, which is also, very interesting. Democrats winning in places like Mississippi and Louisiana is not a good sign for the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And does that carry over into what you think will be an advantage for the Democrats in the presidential race, or are we looking at something different there?
Listen, this is shaping up to be a very strong year for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
We political scientists are really smart. We've studied this for a long time, and we know that Democrats tend to vote for Democrats and Republicans tend to vote for Republicans. And one of the big changes we've seen in the last 2 to 4 years is the number of people in the electorate, the number of people nationally, the number of people in Wisconsin identifying themselves as Democrats versus Republicans is much higher. to whereas the United States or Wisconsin used to be pretty evenly split between Democrats and Republicans in 2000 or 2004, the Democrats now have a strong advantage. Uncertainty about the economy, concern about the war in Iraq, these fundamental factors of economic concerns, war concerns, Democratic Party ID, all indicate this should be a very, very strong year for the Democrats.
Yeah. Time for one more phone call. We have about a little over a minute left. Vicki from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Fine, Vicki. How are you?
I am peachy keen. I have a question. I live in the inner city of Milwaukee, and this political race is showing so much racism. I wanted to know, as I'm recruiting people to get out to vote, how I can explain to them that their vote really does count, and what are we going to do about the disparities in advertising, the negative things? How can we as citizens make a difference besides just voting? How can we show that this is something that is historical both for Obama and for Clinton? How can we show that we are a united force when we have such a big divide?
Well, that's a lot to answer in 30 seconds, but I think you can clearly point to people that votes matter and single votes matter. You can ask Al Gore, who lost by 534 votes in Florida, whether voting matters. Even though what I said, that I think there's fundamental advantages for the Democrats this year, previous elections in the United States in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006 have all been decided by very, very small margins. And things like mobilizing people, things like television advertisements matter at the margin. And we are definitely at a time in American politics where the margin matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for being with us, Professor Goldstein.
Thank you.
Enjoyed the hour. Professor Ken Goldstein, our guest, he is the director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project, coding and analyzing nearly all of the political ads airing in the 2008 federal and gubernatorial races all over the country. Obviously, a lot of work being done on the presidential race and a story being released, results of their work from the primaries, Democratic primaries, which is making a lot of news all over the country today. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader.